On, yes. Thanks, Wilbert. I forgot how much I'd given you there. That's a lot. All right, good morning, folks. Ernie is not here today, so some of us have staged a coup to take control of the pulpit, and we're going to be running the show for the next few weeks here, so I hope he doesn't watch this recording. Not really, but for the next 3 weeks here, it's going to be me, and then Tim, and then Gerald Reimer, my dad, and we're going to be talking about Daniel, as you've probably guessed by now. And we're going to be looking at Daniel the person, specifically, Dan the man, if you will. And we're going to track him over the course of his life, how he reacts to the cultures and the powers, pressures and demands, religions and politics around him. And I'm up first as the youngest member of the trio, so I get, as you see in your bulletin, young man Dan. And I'm going to be covering the first two chapters of the book here today. These chapters cover Daniel's arrival in Babylon, his training to enter the royal service in Babylon, and then the big dramatic display of God's power in him of his younger years, describing and interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's first dream. So that's what we're going to look at here today. In order to start, though, we'll have to set the scene. Understand what the world is here. Daniel isn't in Babylon just visiting. He's not there with his guys, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah on a boys' trip. He hasn't heard Babylon's great this time of year or anything. I find the idea of that kind of funny, which is why I've included that, but I got to switch tones dramatically here because the truth is like really dark. It's world-shattering. The first verse of Daniel reads, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand." Now, there's a lot of debate over the timeline here, when this besieging started versus when it ended, versus when Nebuchadnezzar became king, versus whether they counted his first year as his first year, all of that stuff. But the important thing to note here is the utter collapse of Judah. Their society has fallen. Now, this has been building for a long time. A good chunk of the Old Testament is just about the slowly mounting sins of Israel and Judah, and how they refuse to repent in any meaningful, permanent way. We have histories and poetry and prophecy all detailing this. Isaiah 3 reads, "The look on their faces bears witness against them. They proclaim their sin like Sodom. They do not hide it. Woe to them, for they've brought evil on themselves." But when we finally get to Daniel, the big collapse has happened in the past, and there's no real reminder of why. The book of Daniel spends no time on that part, in part, I think, to put us in Daniel's mindset. Daniel's been a teenager as his world was collapsing. He hasn't been oppressing the poor or anything. He was a child. Daniel was probably not dwelling on the theological ramifications of this destruction. He was just trying to stay alive. That's something that we have no idea about. We have no clue what that's like. Some people still do in this world, unfortunately, to grow up with a sword over their head. And I don't know either. I can't tell you what it's like. But we can try to imagine, and I think it's important to try, because we're going to be tracking with Daniel over the course of his life, and this is how it starts. Judah has been as stable as a volatile ancient Near Eastern kingdom can be for like the last century or so, and that ends here. Daniel's formative moments are at the end of a nation's slow, exhausting, agonizing downfall, and he's swept away along with all these other young Hebrews to Babylon, and then eventually to Persia, though that's getting ahead of ourselves. He's a stranger in a strange land. And in all likelihood, he's 16 or 17 when he's taken by the Babylonians. He's old enough to be useful, but not old enough to be dangerous. That's the key here, and I think that's why he's taken. We know that he's from some kind of upper-class family, because verse 3 tells us that the king told his chief eunuch to bring youths without blemish from the royal family or the nobility. So he's likely being trained as a diplomat or a leader of some kind for his schooling. And he's seized before graduating and removed from all his mentors and teachers, but that's the foundation, both of his work abilities and probably his faith too. And guys with a good foundation, but not much more than that, is exactly who the Babylonians want. By their way of thinking, if he had a bunch of experience already, at best, he wouldn't be teachable, He wouldn't be adaptable to new Babylonian ways, and thus he wouldn't be useful. And at worst, he'd just be like actively plotting against the Babylonians, right? But a young guy with a lot of promise, though, well, his brain's still malleable. He can still learn a new language and culture without too much trouble. And also, you want a guy with a lot of promise with you. And also away from the other guys, too. It cuts both ways. It's like any sports team. If you sign a valuable player away from another team, you're not just happy that they're on your team, although that's true. You're also happy that they're not contributing to the other team anymore. Particularly if they're conference rivals, you're glad they're with you now. But even if they were somewhere else, at least they're not with those guys anymore. So, in a mixture of all of this, you know, geopolitical maneuvering and stuff, Daniel arrives in Babylon. Like we said, stranger in a strange land. And one of the main questions of the book is how to be faithful in this new context. How will their principles survive here? Many of the stories in this book are about the pressure that Daniel and the other young Hebrews will face in a foreign culture with its learning and its expectations. And the repeated answer is that when they're faithful to God, God makes it possible to keep their faith. And not just survive there, but actually excel. Goldingay writes that no young man ever goes from a country home to a large city, say to a great metropolis, without grave temptations crossing his path on his entrance. Tale as old as time, he says, and we'll see very shortly what the temptations that Daniel faces are. Verse 4 says that Daniel and the other Hebrews are to be brought to stand in the king's palace to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans, and the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank, and they were to be educated for 3 years. So like magician college. Baldwin writes that to begin to study Babylonian literature was to enter a completely alien thought world. According to the Sumerians and the Babylonians, two classes of persons inhabited the universe, the human race and the gods. And preeminence belonged to the gods. But they were not all equal. At the lower end of the divine scale came just a ton of minor deities and demons, while a trinity of great gods, Anu, Enlil, and Ea, stood at the head. And the modern scholar will observe that many of these gods are personifications of parts of nature. The sun god, the moon god, there are obvious examples of this. So this is the environment that Daniel's been dropped into. He goes on, the writer of Daniel implies no objection to the study of a polytheistic literature in which there's magic and sorcery and charms and astrology, even though these had long been banned in Israel. These young men from Jerusalem's court needed to be able to study this literature objectively without allowing it to undermine their faith. Evidently, the work of Jeremiah, Zephaniah, and Habakkuk had not been in vain. In order to witness to their God in the Babylonian court, they had to understand the culture of those around them, just as the Christian today must work hard at the culture amongst in which he lives, if different thought worlds are to ever meet. So before we get to any actual test, this environment he's in, the reason he's there is already very testing. It's an environment that, if he's not careful, it's going to chip away at him, just bit after bit, day after day, making him more like them. Unless he's resolute in his devotion to God. And we'll learn about his devotion in the first real story here. Verse 8 reads, "But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank." And that's pretty much the whole story. We could stop right there. From the very beginning, Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself. Daniel resolved. Despite pressure, despite scrutiny, despite threats, despite danger, Daniel resolved to be faithful to the Lord. Another commentator writes that he was going to do right today and let the tomorrows take care of themselves. That firmness of purpose and the strength of the Lord was the secret of his success. Right there, that very moment, he overcame. And from that hour, from that moment, he could go on conquering because he had started right. We'll come back to this at the end, of course, but that's the point of this entire message. So if you paid attention there, you can zone out later. It's fine. Daniel's success is telegraphed right here. He'd started right, and therefore he would continue right. It reminds me of Jesus' parable of the talents. When the man given 5 talents turns it into 5 more, his master gives him that famous seal of approval. "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little. I will set you over much." The same principle is at play here. Daniel's being faithful in a very little thing. But because he's faithful, he'll be given greater and greater assignments. This isn't some grandstand pleading for the survival of his people like Esther. It's just food. But Ford writes, "Could it be that the depth of love is best revealed in the little things? Great doors often swing on little hinges." I like that line. Great doors often swing on little hinges. But let's get to the actual faithfulness here. Why is Daniel refusing the king's food and wine? Why does he do that? Nearest I can tell, there's three possible reasons, perhaps more than one in play at any time. One commentary I read suggested that, you know, given all the sorcery and polytheism at play, this food's been involved in idolatry. Maybe it's even been sacrificed to idols. That's why Daniel wants no part of it. But I read a bunch of other stuff that said that's a New Testament problem that they're reading into the Old. There's not enough evidence for that. Secondly, and this is what I've always assumed, is that this Babylonian food violated the Torah food laws. And Daniel, while willing to go by a new name and willing to accept new training, is not willing to break his God's laws in this way. I think this is almost certainly part of it. We know for a fact that the Babylonian court's diet included both pig, which they loved, and regularly horse meat too. Both break Torah food laws. But Baldwin points out that Daniel also refuses the king's wine, I quote, "against which there was no prohibition, except in the case of Rechabites and Nazarites, and there's no indication that Daniel and his friends were either of those." What he suggests, then, is quite simple. Eating together means something. Particularly in an ancient Near Eastern context, the act of someone cooking for you and hosting you and you accepting it and sharing that meal together, that's almost covenantal. It's a significant act of kinship, of fellowship. Look at Genesis 31, where Jacob and Laban have negotiated their way from the edge of conflict back into trust and alliance again. They build a pillar as a long-lasting symbol of their agreement. And then verse 54 reads, "So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac, and Jacob offered a sacrifice in the hill country, and he called his kinsmen to eat bread. They ate bread and spent the night in the hill country." So the eating together sealed their binding together, a human alliance. Another example is when Moses and Aaron and the 70 elders of Israel go up Mount Sinai and see God in Exodus 24. In a time of a lot of agreements and promises and covenants, verse 11 reads, "They beheld God and they ate and drank." The eating together sealed their binding together, a divine alliance. So maybe, in addition to the breaking of the Torah food laws, Daniel looks at the implication of eating the king's food, the signal that it'll send that says, "I'm with you, I'm one of you." And he goes, "But I'm not one of them. I'm a child of God. I'm called to be in the world, but not of the world." Baldwin finishes by saying the defilement he feared wasn't a ritual one, it was a moral one, arising from the subtle flattery of gifts and favors and the hidden implications of loyal support. Daniel's first support is always to God before the king, something that's going to get him in trouble down the line, but God will get him out of it. And so his conscience decides that he can't eat or drink the king's food. So the story's all in the decision there, but we'll rip through the rest of it. Daniel asks the chief of the eunuchs if he can have an exception, and the chief is like, "I like you, but I'm not about to disregard the king's orders." So Daniel kind of suggests this test to the steward who's actually in charge of the food, where he and his friends will only have vegetables and water, and they'll compare their health and appearance after 10 days. The steward agrees, they do that, they look great, they get to do it permanently. And we learn a couple of interesting things at the end of this. Verse 17 reads, "As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And at the end of the time, when the king had commanded they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. The king spoke with them, and among all of them, none were found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king." So, these young men are truly exceptional. Truly exceptional, even among the best of the best. They stand out with their knowledge and their wisdom. And secondly, I don't really have a grand point here. This is just a little aside. But doesn't this sound like Joseph? Joseph, the patriarch, who's a young Hebrew, swept away from his family to a strange kingdom, elevated to be right beside the king because of his wisdom, and specifically the Lord using him to interpret dreams. I don't have a grand theory or takeaway here, but that's interesting to me. Young people who want to serve God planted at the heart of empires, mostly considered God's people's enemies. There's a theme there. Anyway, that passage ends with this sentence, "And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus." A lot is going to happen before Cyrus's reign, but the text is telling us right now that Daniel is going to be a faithful witness in this elevated position for a long time. Between the hand of God, his own obvious value and wisdom, and the respect of others that those things produce, he has a longer career here than you would even think is possible. These are Pusey's words on the subject. "Daniel continued even into the first year of King Cyrus," are the simple words, but what a volume of tried faithfulness is unrolled by them. Amid all the intrigues, indigenous at all times in the dynasties of despotism, where intrigue rolls around so surely and suddenly, amid all the envy toward a foreign captive in as high an office as the king's counselor, amid all the trouble incidental to the insanity of the king or the murder of two of his successors, in that whole critical period for his people, Daniel continued. He started faithful, and thus he continued faithfully. All right, chapter 2. Here we have Daniel's big break. We know his mindset, his attitude of devotion to the Lord, and this will show us what that faithfulness looks like. So Nebuchadnezzar has a dream in the night. He awakens, and verse 2 says, "The king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams." Wiseman writes that listing these four sort of serves as shorthand to refer to all of them. So Nebuchadnezzar is demanding that every advisor is on the hook for this. I mean, clearly they're not all there, right there, because Daniel and his friends aren't there. But they'll be held responsible all the same. The king is putting the sword above them all. And what the verse says they'll be responsible for is telling the king his dream. That's the twist here. Nebuchadnezzar isn't just asking for an interpretation of the dream that he'll describe. That can be faked. What he's demanding is for them to tell him his dream and then interpret it. Now, I've always read this as a selfish, bratty indulgence of power. And that's definitely in play here, but some commentaries pointed out a very obvious read, but one that I'd never just really thought about before. Maybe Nebuchadnezzar just forgot his dream. That kind of paints him a bit more sympathetically to me. I don't know. He's frustrated. He's had this dream, and he knows it's important. He just knows it. But the morning comes, and he cannot for the life of him remember it. I feel like I've had similar experiences where I've woken up from a dream that I thought was great, for whatever reason, and decided that I'd be annoying and tell someone about it. But then the moment comes, and I can't remember what was so good about it, nor can I remember any details about it, nor can I remember anything about it, actually. All I can remember is the feeling that it gave me. It felt significant. And I don't even value dreams like that. That's not a part of my cultural background. I place pretty much no weight in dreams. I don't think they mean anything. I don't think about them at all. Babylon, by contrast, thought about them a lot. They kept records of dreams and of the events that followed them so that the advisors could use them as resources. There were whole careers dedicated to the study and the interpretation of dreams, Daniel among them. They believed the divine whispered to them in the night. So maybe Nebuchadnezzar's haunted by this. He feels pestered by his own forgetfulness. He's convinced that the dream he can't remember is important. Or maybe he just sucks. I don't know. In any case, his decree is death unless anyone comes up with an answer. And comes up with one quick. When Daniel hears about this, that's the first thing he asks. Verse 14 and 15 read, "Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, captain of the king's guard, who'd gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. And he declared to Arioch, the king's captain, 'Why is the decree of the king so urgent?' Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel." Daniel's first question is, why the hurry? He doesn't ask why it's insane. He doesn't say that it's ridiculous or unfair, which is probably what I would do. We're told that he replied with prudence and discretion. His wisdom continues. He doesn't panic. He doesn't blurt out something that'll put him in even more danger. He's just buying time. But not in the way that the Chaldeans were. The king tells those guys, quote, "I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. If you don't make the dream known to me, there's but one sentence for you. You've agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change." So they're buying time out of desperation. They had no clue how to solve the king's request. And their manner of buying time was to speak lying and corrupt words, to tell the king soothing things that they thought he wanted to hear until the heat died down and he moved on to something else. By contrast, Daniel's buying time because he trusts God. He's saying, "God hasn't told me the answer yet, but I'm going to ask him to, and I trust that he will. So why don't you tell me when it works for you for me to come in and tell you?" That's a totally, wildly different form of buying time. That's a guy that's confident that God will deliver. He's making an appointment to interpret a dream, and he doesn't even know what it is yet, let alone the interpretation. But God has had him so far, and he trusts that God will continue to hold him close. I can't imagine the stress of this. Verse 17 reads, "Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon." I think the language here really sells the desperation. They're not just praying, they're seeking mercy. Their great learning will not help them. Their intrinsic wisdom will not suddenly inspire them to answer. They're wise and they're capable, but this is beyond them. The only hope they have is God showing mercy to them, blessing them with something that they have no hope of getting on their own. And he does. Verse 19 reads, "Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night, and Daniel blessed the God of heaven." Daniel's prayer of blessing here is entirely about God, praising his greatness, and more specifically, the way he gives. The prayer is thanking God for the blessings he gives to us. Daniel says that God changes times and seasons. He gives wisdom and knowledge. He reveals deep and hidden things, and he's given me wisdom and might. Baldwin writes that relief found expression in a spontaneous hymn of thanksgiving to the only God who could so answer prayer. But there was also awe, because that same God, unseen and infinitely great, had been directly in touch with him personally. What a wonderful moment for Daniel. God has come through for him, and he's come through for him personally, relationally. Daniel knows his God. God's blessed him with an answer he could have never gotten on his own, and so Daniel gives him the glory. Compare that with Arioch. The guard introduces him and says, "I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who will make them make known to the king the interpretation." He's taking credit. "Lord, look, my lord, what I've done for you. I've found this man." Daniel, by contrast, says, "No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and visions of your head as you lay in bed are these." And off he goes. And I'm really not all that concerned with the content of the dream, to be honest with you guys. There's potent imagery of a towering statue with tactile materials, and destruction comes crashing in, and it's all a metaphor for kingdoms and powers. It's what Nebuchadnezzar needs to hear, and it points to God's sovereignty, but it doesn't really affect Daniel himself all that much. So we'll read the end of the story, we'll observe a couple of things about it, and then we'll wrap up. Daniel ends his interpretation of the dream in verse 45, saying, I'm going to read the rest of the story here, "A great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation sure. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel and commanded that an offering and incense be offered up to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, "Truly, your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you've been able to reveal this mystery." Then the king gave Daniel high honors and many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province in Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court. So the first thing to note here is that Daniel emphasizes God's power and the certainty of what this means. And Nebuchadnezzar goes, "Whew, good job, everyone. That was awesome." He doesn't really dwell much on what this dream actually means, even though isn't that all he wanted out of this? Wasn't that the whole point of this entire thing? Baldwin writes that Daniel lays stress on the certainty of the dream and its interpretation because he wants the king to face up to its immediate implications. This is just what Nebuchadnezzar did not do. He asked no questions, either about the future or Daniel's great God. Relieved that he was the head of gold and his fears were groundless, he concerned himself with the present and the man who met his need. Despite Daniel's assurances that it was God who both brought about the interpretation and is going to bring about the events interpreted, Nebuchadnezzar can't get past the guy in front of him. And the final note here, this talk of Nebuchadnezzar, quote, paying homage to Daniel, commanding that an offering and sacrifice be offered up to him, well, that might set off some alarm bells in our heads. Is this not the exact type of thing that Paul and Silas aggressively shut down in Acts 14? Paul heals a guy, and we read that priests, quote, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifice with the crowds. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they tore their garments and they rushed out into the crowd, crying out, "Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men of like nature with you, and we bring you good news, so that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that's in them." They say a bit more, and verse 18 says, "Even with all these words, they barely restrained the people from offering sacrifice to them." Daniel, on the other hand, seems to have no problem accepting a sacrifice that's offered to him. So what gives? Maybe Daniel, learned as he is in Babylonian ways, has just decided that this is not a battle worth fighting. You got to pick your arguments, and the judgment call he makes here is that picking this one would draw attention away from the main point. That's possible. But I think the more resonant read here has to do with the dream itself. Nebuchadnezzar represents Babylon. When Daniel interprets the dream, he says that each part of the statue is a different kingdom. The head of gold is Babylon. Or the head of gold is Babylon. And yet Daniel's direct quote is, "You are the head of gold." The person stands in, like a representative or an ambassador. And the dream ends with another kingdom, a perfect kingdom that will stand forever and is set up by God, God's kingdom. And Daniel's the servant of God, so he's God's representative in the same way that Nebuchadnezzar is Babylon's representative. In this way, Ford writes that, quote, "Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges the king of heaven in the person of his captive slave in Babylon." He acknowledges the king of heaven in the person of his captive slave in Babylon. So between representatives, it's like Babylon bowing down to God, which is kind of cool. The sacrifice from Nebuchadnezzar to Daniel is really a sacrifice to God through his servant. And I think that's why Daniel allows it. We've seen through the way he speaks that mistaking God's power for his own is not something he really struggles with. All right, so those are the first two chapters of Daniel, with our focus dialed in on Daniel the person, Dan the man. So what are our takeaways here? I got three kind of loose ones, and we'll work backwards. So firstly, like Joseph before him, Daniel is eager to give God the glory for the things he's enabling Daniel to do. Nebuchadnezzar and Arioch both refer to him as the man who can interpret. And Daniel's quick every time to say he cannot, but God can. And in his prayer, he doesn't just thank God for making, quote, "making known to me what we asked of you." He also thanks him generally for, quote, "giving me wisdom and might." Daniel ascribes everything he has to God. And therefore, he's calm and he's confident because he knows he's in God's hands. The missionaries I worked with in Lesotho said this about their vehicles all the time. The vehicles break down constantly there, which is a massive hassle. And they always said, like, the go-to line was, well, it's not my car, it's God's car. Whatever he wants to have happen with it is the best plan. Daniel has the same approach, and I think we would be better off in our lives with that approach too. It's God's thing. This is God's blessing. Secondly, faithfulness in a sea of influences. It can't be stated enough. Daniel remaining faithful to the Lord in this environment of sorcery and magic and power and intrigue was not easy, and it was not accidental. He was deliberate and devoted. He was in a culture that sapped at him, that tried in a thousand ways to get him to take his eye off the ball, to look anywhere but at the Lord. Not to put too fine a point on it, but not unlike our culture. But much more so, make no mistake, it was even harder in Daniel's environment to remain faithful to God than it is in ours. And we'll learn about his prayer habits later in the book, but we already know just from his behavior towards food that Daniel is looking to ground himself in God's will every day. That's how he stays faithful in this place. And that's how we remain faithful too, by looking to God in the little things as well as the big ones, every day, day after day. Which leads directly into my final point, which is that Daniel started well with small decisions. His choice of diet while studying at the Babylonian Magician College, his diet is small potatoes, no pun intended. It's the smallest choice he makes. Every other situation he's in for the rest of the book, every consultation, every vision, every dream of Armageddon, the stakes are way higher. But he's built good habits here, and they'll carry him forward. I want to take us out with this very simple sentence from Ford. Quote, the initial test is to be followed by others, but the outcome of the later tests was determined mainly by this initial test. This test will be followed by a lot of others, but those have already been decided by how he responded to the first one. From here on out, he's good. The stakes go up, but Daniel, the person, doesn't really change much over the course of the book. He doesn't need to. He's aligned himself correctly on God's path. And no matter how high or how far he's flung, he took the time before it all to aim himself toward God. Let's aim ourselves towards God now. Before crazy events come, before we're flung into new circumstances, before the tests ramp up in intensity, aim yourself toward God now, and he'll take care of the rest. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for the example of Daniel, for his faithfulness in a culture that did not want that and did not accept that. And despite that, he grounded himself in you day after day and was able to stand before kings and praise you, Lord. What a cool thing, God. I pray that we could be people that have that same spirit in us, people that are looking to you day after day, ready to speak your word before whoever's in front of us, from the greatest to the smallest. We love you a lot, Lord Jesus. We pray this in your name. Amen. All right, I think we don't really have time for questions, so maybe worship team can come up and we'll do that.